sing the blessed sentiments of this song, I wonder if we realize how contrary to human experience are the words expressed herein. Thy will be done, I will not fear the lot provided by thy love. Though clouds and darkness shroud me here, I know that all is bright above. I say contrary to human experience, because experiences which are difficult, experiences which are costly, experiences which are trying, are so fear-evoking and fear-inspiring that mankind reacts instinctively and almost reflexly to this emotion of fear. And for us to be able to sing, I will not fear, though clouds and darkness shroud me here, I know that all is bright above, dear friends, for you to be able to sing that with meaningfulness and beyond merely verbalizing, to be able to live this in your lives, is a testimony, dear friends, as to God's acceptance of you and of his action in your lives. Because there is no greater emotion, or one closer to humankind, than this emotion of fear. This set of reactions to a situation which, when carried out to their expression, we are able to identify as a fearful or as a terrifying reaction. And this ability that mankind has not always been indigent to mankind. Fear as such, fear as is known and fear as seen abroad today, only was introduced to the human experience some 6,000 years ago. When Adam was perfect, when he was in the Garden of Eden, when he was at one with his Creator, and he with his helpmate lived in this perfect, blissful condition, there was no fear. There was no need to be fearful. There was a perfect society, a perfect little world for Adam. And had he proven himself faithful, indeed he would have lived there forever in a condition of life which would be forever free from any dangers or free from any concern or alarm or fright. But we know, dear friends, that having failed in this test, having proven that the creature was greater to him than the Creator, Adam thus was committed into the unfinished earth, where by the sweat of his brow he would earn his daily bread, and with thorns and thistles would the earth give forth. And thus when God confronted Adam with his defection, had confronted Adam with his sin of disobedience, we find Adam seeking refuge away from the Lord, and the Lord calling unto Adam said unto him, Where art thou? And Adam, realizing that the eyes of the Lord are everywhere and searching out the deepest crevices, that he could never escape from the presence and from the glance and from the presence of the Lord, then he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. You see, here was the first evidence of fear. With sin there came fear, and man's reaction to the realization that he is undone, that he is incomplete, inadequate to face a divine Creator, and even to face the rigors of now an unfinished, undone, cursed earth. And thus, what a sad, tragic commentary, how fear, this emotion, was then evoked, and how this emotion has been compounded and magnified and amplified throughout the 6,000 years until today, this very hour. The age in which we live has been called the age of fear. My, our social planners, our philosophers, our thinkers are all aware that the very air seems to be electrified with a imminence of danger. Almost a catastrophic kind of atmosphere pervades that the young people and old people alike are just living day to day with the old sensual philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die. There's nothing beyond the immediate experience, nothing beyond the present. And thus last year, when there was this Cuban crisis, when there was a danger of a possible armed conflict, how the whole world with bated breath seemed to be clinging on the verge of a precipice, on the brink of disaster, and how fear just seemed to be everywhere like the dark night that covered Egypt when the plagues were there. So even today, the fear is so thick that one can almost cut it with a knife as we look upon the earthly scene. And this was not as unexpected. And this, dear friends, should encourage us that we have really believed in a more sure word of prophecy. Because recall what the Master said. He said, in this time of the end, when conditions would be at a focal point, when the kingdom of God would be right at hand, that men's hearts shall fail them for fear as they look abroad on the things of this earth. It is the fear of the unknown that they are reacting to in such a failing attitude. Their whole hearts and their whole outlook seems to melt away, because literally that word there means a impasse. It means a no way out. And thus, as mankind looks upon the present scene, and in their council of nations, whether it be the League or it be the United Nations, they find that they are just going from one blunder to the next, and no matter how they try, they cannot put a new patch upon this old garment and this old fabric of society, because God has doomed it, and it has to go down into complete dissolution and destruction. But nonetheless, as individuals caught up in this vortex, in this whirlpool, this whirlwind of trouble, this emotion of fear has been so deeply etched into the lives of all these people that so often it seems to govern their very action and their activities. And what is true, dear friends, of individuals is also true of groups. We find that the prophet Isaiah, looking down the corridors of time to the present era in which we live, and surveying the scene of various societies and segments of societies, looks into this nominal system, this great Babylonish system, and he says in the 33rd chapter and the 14th verse, he says, "The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? And indeed, verily may the sinners and the hypocrites in nominal Zion be fearful and afraid today, as they see their cherished doctrines, as they see their cherished organizations and groups and sectarian denominations being swept away and engulfed by the rising tide of lawlessness. And as a result of this fear, there's a great movement abroad today for union, for combination, for getting strength by combining together. And yes, and even at this moment, 4,000 or 5,000 miles away, there is this ecumenical council endeavoring to patch together and to hold against the onrushing tide of the Lord's great work, trying to hold the status quo. And the only things that bring such strange bedfellows together, that would bring together supposedly the various stretches of the ecclesiastical heavens, to bring them together, the only motivation that would do this is this one of self-survival, for an endeavoring because of the fear they see about them, in order to hold together as best they can. And what we see on the ecclesiastical realm, dear friends, we see on the worldly realm, and nations themselves are fearing as they are being jolted and tottered, and as the fire of God's jealousy is now devouring them, they would seek for protection. They would seek to amalgamate and combine. And the same is true of the individual worker. How the Lord indicated that there would come a time when his great prophecy of Matthew 24 would be fulfilled. But there would come a time when individual workmen even would run to the mountains and endeavor to find refuge in them, and would have the mountains fall on them to cover them from the difficult times that are coming. And thus they joined labor unions. Thus they amalgamated various benevolent and fraternal organizations. Thus they tried to provide for their own future security and for their own benefits. But in so doing, dear friends, it is only the fear, only the fearful foreboding of what is yet to come, that impels them to work together, not for the welfare of their other colleague or fellow man, but more for their own individual safety and for their own well-being. And it is this basic fear that impels, that drives men together. And thus the Lord indicated that he would gather himself all these nations and then pour out upon them the fire of his jealousy. And thus do we, dear friends, living in today's society, thus do we find ourselves caught up in this electrifying aurora, you might say, of this emotion, and how easy it is for us to be carried away with some of the same attitudes and reactions as the world about us. This fear is so basic in our being and in our framework that when the various writers of the Bible came to explain it and to talk about it and to prophesy about it, they had to use in the Old Testament some 20 different words to give the various grades of meanings of fear. And in the New Testament, there are some 8 Greek words which all relate to this matter of fear and which are translated in our King James Version as being fear. And I am quoting the Strong's Concordance as my basis of thought. We find thus that fear is not a condition of at one-ment with God, but rather fear is an estrangement from God. When man was one with God, there was no need to fear, nor was there any such reaction. And thus we have told us by the Apostle John, when he described to us in comparing love and the virtues of love and the quality of love, he said, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love." Therefore, John is telling us that the absence of love really produces fear, and that when we will have perfect love, there will be no more fear. And just think, dear friends, as we consider the perfect society that is to come, and I always think of that wonderful little quotation that Brother Russell has given us in the first volume, just close your eyes for a moment to the scenes of the present, and then he depicts, I think, in as eloquent or as beautiful and as prophetic a manner as is possible in words, he then tells us a little bit about the perfect society, and one of the things that will be characteristic of this perfect world, this God's kingdom, after the end of that little season, will be the absence of fear. There'll be no dangerous animals, there'll be no ravenous beasts, there'll be no satanic adversary to thwart the welfare and the happiness and the eternal bliss of all creation throughout the illimitable future. And John continues to say that fear hath torment. A torment here is the kind of plaguing. It's the kind of anxiety that gnaws upon the vitals of one's being and which even has its reflection in one's physical well-being. Today, a whole series, a whole science of medicine called psychosomatic medicine is built up around this very point. And almost as though to predate and to anticipate some of the latest medical findings, we remember in the 6th volume how Brother Russell treats this matter of fear, how he documented one instance when this was, I'm sure, unthought of in scientific circles, how this one man submitted himself to an experiment, and how, because he was a convicted, doomed criminal who was going to die on the gallows anyway, he was used as a guinea pig, as an experiment. He was permitted to thrust his arm in through a panel, and there they told him that they were going to cut his jugular vein, or cut his main vein, rather, and that slowly he would bleed to death. Instead of doing this, they merely dropped warm water, tepid water, upon his pulses, as if to give him the feeling as though, yes, this is blood seeking, dropping out of his veins, and that within a few hours he was going to bleed to death. Actually, there was no incision, there was no cut, there was no draining of his blood. But yet, before that night was out, that criminal was dead. He was dead of fright because of the torment that this fear of life, the fear of death, had for him. And therefore, the torment that is in fear is evident about us everywhere, in the rising incidence of mental imbalance, in the physical complaints which are so rampant today. I say, dear friends, how much we are prone to the sensitivity of about us, and how if we are not constantly abiding in the love of God and endeavoring to have more and more this spirit of perfect love which casteth out fear, we will find ourselves again caught up in this same frightening torment. We find, dear friends, that fear as such does not draw the world to God. This has been the one proof that we have learned from the 2,000 years of papacy's influence. We have found that the doctrine of hell, which has been intended to frighten men into serving of God, which has been intended to make them so fearful about the hereafter that they would be concerned about the present, and that they therefore would endeavor to keep within civil bounds and not transgress too greatly the laws of nations and of men. But rather than bringing men to God, this has but led him further away. The fear which these doctrines and these dogmas and these blasphemous teachings have inculcated have only blinded the minds of the hearts and repudiated God in their senses, because, and rightly so, who would want to serve such a monstrous, such a bloodthirsty creator that these doctrines and these dogmas have made him out to be? But because of the dark age doctrines and the dark age blasphemies, the minds of the people now are turned away from God, and they now turn to infidelism, agnosticism, or downright atheism, because they do not want to serve and worship a creedal creator. And therefore, dear friends, as we look into ourselves, do we have a fear of man? Do we have the fear which brings torment? Indeed, dear friends, fear, as it is constituted in the human breast, is often an essential reaction. And this makes it so difficult to us that we have to have a sense of fear in order to survive either physically or even spiritually. By that I mean, because of the organism of man, because man is a sin-cursed individual, nature and God had to build in an element of fear out of sheer survival and protection. Well, what do you say, Brother Luke? Why or how can fear be necessary and helpful? Well, I say, dear friends, that life could not have existed this long on this planet without fear, because there are certain things which man should fear, and if he does not fear, he is a fool. For example, if I, in coming to the meeting, should be walking across the crowded thoroughfare, if I were not fearful of the onrushing traffic, I would, without any reason or without any thought, walk right out in the midst of it and be almost immediately killed. But because I have a healthy respect and fear for what might happen if I came in the way of an onrushing vehicle, I would immediately exercise caution against putting myself in any fearful situation. Or perchance, if I should unknowingly step out into off the curb into the mainstream of traffic and suddenly turn around and see a car darting at me, immediately that observation would relay a message to my brain, and there the brain would send impulses down to the adrenal glands, and there the glands would secrete a fluid into one's bloodstream, and then all of a sudden we would get strength to leap out of the way, and we would wonder where this newfound strength suddenly came from. It was only because there was a reaction, there was a fear to that situation, that the body was able to mobilize itself and then gain safety through action. And without this kind of reaction, I say, dear friends, life could not persist here in a sin-cursed, danger and hostile, unfriendly world, because the earth itself had been cursed, and man had to defend himself against the ravages of nature and of a hostile environment. And thus, fear, while it is helpful, and in this regard, fear is like pain. While we think of pain as being an unfortunate and a very undesirable element, nonetheless, pain is a great blessing. Had you ever thought that if we did not experience pain, how we would have difficulty in, again, surviving? If I did not have a pain in my tooth, as a warning signal that there is some decay there, I would not go to the dentist and have him clear up the condition and save that tooth. There are some individuals who are born with neurological disturbances and they cannot experience pain. And thus, when they break their arm, they're not aware that there is a break. Or when they have a pain in there, they would not experience a pain or fever. And therefore, the malady or the condition would be so great that before anyone would know of their condition, life would be at an ebb, and they would perhaps die before it can be even diagnosed. And thus, fear like pain is a sentinel, is a warning of danger. But when fear becomes to be the motivating force, when it gets to be the driver and the primary way of conducting oneself, then it becomes a torment. Then it becomes a great disservant. And as we look through the scriptures, the wise men tells us, of course, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And as we look into our concordances and our lexicons, we realize that certainly this is not a good translation of that word fear, but we know that it is the reverence of the Lord. It is the love for Him that really is the basis of all wisdom, all true understanding. Because one must have faith in God and to know that He is, and that He is the rewarder of those that diligently search Him or seek for Him. This, you see, is a reverential attitude. This is a fearful attitude, an awe-inspiring, a love-engendering desire to reach out to the wonderful God who has done so much for us. And at this point, with this as a starting, we are able then to work out our salvation, and we are able to accept the Lord and all of the provisions which He has given to us. But we need, you see, to have this awe, this respect, this filial affection for God, and from then on, we then possess the proper attitude of heart, the proper plowed up subsoil of life that God can plant the seeds of truth therein, and from whence will spring the various fruits of righteousness. Dear friends, we are to be fearful in things spiritual. We are to be so concerned about how things are with us in our new creature life daily that we ought to be constantly asking the Lord as to our rightness with Him. We all can recall how the apostle speaks of our Lord and his experience in this regard. Remember in the 5th chapter of Hebrews, and I believe the 17th verse, the 7th verse, in which, speaking of the experience in Pentecost, Paul writes, the experience in Gethsemane, Paul writes, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong cryings and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Paul brings us back in mind to this eventful night in Gethsemane, where the Master, knowing that the cross was before him, knowing that he was going to be nailed up as a blasphemer against God, with strong tears and crying, was heard in that he feared. He was concerned, dear friends. He was anxious, lest anything that should have been done by him was left unfinished. If in any way he might not have fulfilled in every jot and tittle that the law required of him, he was fully aware that he had no one to stand before God for him. You and I have a blessed advocate whose righteousness and whose robe of Christ's righteousness can cover us, and those sins which we commit because of ignorance, or those sins which may even be partially willful, God will cover these, even though there will be a measure of chastisements with these. But nonetheless, Jesus knew that there was no such intercessor with God for him, and that if he in any manner came short of all that was required, that his death would have been an eternal one, that verily he would have gone into oblivion. And thus he cried with strong tears and feared, lest he had not done everything according to what was written. God has said, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things he suffered. Ah, friends, This has been a stumbling block to many who have not the philosophy of the present truth on the matter of Jesus' life and his character development. It is one thing, dear friends, to have a perfection of being, and indeed Jesus, from his very birth in Bethlehem, was perfect. And his perfection of being as an individual was the work of God. God gave him, God gave that Logos life, a perfect human body. And thus, that was of God's doing. But the perfection of character, dear friends, is something that God cannot do. This is only the work of the intelligent creation. And thus, Jesus was made perfect by the things he suffered. And thus, Jesus, who as the Logos throughout millennia of time had always been obedient to God, had been his instrument, his means of creation. This very same life had to be proven to be obedient. He had to learn obedience. Now, under different and adverse circumstances, under the adversity of a hostile and a vengeful society and a great adversary thwarting all of God's endeavors. And thus the work of perfection of character was the work of an intelligent creator who, in cooperation with God's provisions, were willing to submit gladly their all for the performance of God's will. Adam had perfection of being, and he had perfection of character in a limited sense. But because he was not able to develop a character in its fullness, he was defected from God. Christ had a perfect body as the man Christ Jesus, and as the new creature Christ Jesus developed a perfect character which God was able to raise out of the tomb and give up the very nature of himself, namely divinity. And therefore Jesus was made perfect by the things he suffered, and he feared that he might have come short in any of his service. And then too, dear friends, Paul, in giving us the logic of the high calling and how the high calling had been prefigured and illustrated by many of the earlier types given to the Jewish nation, how Paul in the book of Hebrews lifts up a great veil of mystery and is able, with deep, profound spiritual insight, relate so much of the Jewish experiences and customs and teachings and tabernacle shadows to the New Testament and to this new and living way which was now being opened because of the work and life of Christ. And Paul then, in the third chapter of Hebrews, he endeavors to urge the brethren to consider more their high calling and to contrast it in its spiritual height to the Jewish arrangement, which is merely a little prototype, a little prefigurement of what would be accomplished on a far more sublime and spiritual level. And Paul then, endeavoring to stir up the minds, the pure minds of the church, he speaks about how, if we are made partakers of Christ, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end, and he says, while it is said today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation, for some when they had heard did provoke, albeit not all that came out of Egypt by Moses. Here were numerous instances where the typical people of God had proven themselves so unworthy of God's providences and God's leading, how at the very time when God was giving the law, the Ten Commandments from the Mount, how at the very time that Moses for 40 days had disappeared and communed with God and gotten the instructions, that the camp of Israel was just rallying around a golden calf. They wanted a visible means of support. They were fearful that, here, this leader has now abandoned us. He's probably gone forever. Now, who will be our God? Who shall we look up to? Who shall we accept as a leader? And because of the humanity, always wanting physical, tangible evidences, they brought about this golden calf. Oh, what provocation this was to God, and how he had almost threatened, he had threatened to blot out that nation, and because of the intercession of Moses, they were spared, and God bore with them for some 40 years until they were brought into the land of Canaan. Oh, how much provocation was there But yet the Lord in his long-suffering mercy, and also the Lord in his need, and his knowledge of the need for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age are come, he did have these experiences continue with Israel, so that we might learn therefrom. And Paul goes on to say, but with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcass fell in the wilderness? And to whom sware he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? So we see that they should not enter, could not enter in because of unbelief. And then Paul launches out to what I think is the point of our reference here. Let us therefore fear lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Dear friends, we are told here to fear. We should be alarmed. We should be concerned. Oh, the word used here for fear is not the same word used in the sense of fright and terror, but rather it is the word of alarm. We should be alerted lest a promise is left short of us, and that we should fail to come into the rest which God has for us. We should be so sensitively attuned in, so acute, that reflexly, like the needle of the pole, our consciences would be so attuned that we would seek the Lord's grace, seek the Lord's favor at every hand if at any point we should deviate. You know, as that hymn expresses it, if to the right or left I stray that moment, Lord, reprove, and the goodness on thy, and in thy goodness take away all hindrance to thy love. I want a principle within, a jealous godly fear, a sensibility of sin and a pain to feel it near. I want the least omission to feel of the fire of fond desire to quench the kindling of my soul, to catch the wandering of my soul and quench the kindling fire. This kind of sensitivity, this soul being alert, this is fearfulness, and this is the fear which Paul expresses as being vital to a Christian's defense. Because if we are not aware of the danger, just like with our natural body, if we are not aware of the dangerous condition which we might slip into, we would not be able to do something about it. But let us therefore fear, dear friends, lest there be a promise that we should come short of it. And then too, dear friends, we are told that to have a godly fear, and that godly fear worketh repentance. See, there's all kinds of fear, but a godly fear is one which is out of respect and adoration to him. And further, Paul says in Hebrews 12:28, wherefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably, with reverence and godly fear, or worship, or homage, or devotion. And only as we have this guarding the sentinels of our hearts, dear friends, can we also experience what Paul elsewhere told us in Philippians 2:12, when he said that we are to work out our salvation. Are we to do this with flowery beds of ease? Are we to do this, dear friends, in a careless, indifferent manner? Why, not at all. Hear the way Paul expresses it. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always behaved, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, dear friends. Let us not take lightly the great work which is entrusted to us, because we have verily in our hands our eternal existences. We have daily at our disposal the issue of life or death. Are we endeavoring to do all those things in conformity with the covenant which we have made? If we shall so do, then we shall live and have life in its fullness and its abundance. If we shall not, dear friends, then we have naught but the foreboding of ostracization from God and possible entrance into, verily, life extinction itself. And thus, dear friends, we are to have fear. There are fears that we will have of our human form. Hear Paul in 2 Corinthians 7:5, when he tries to tell the Corinthian brethren about his own experiences in this narrow way, and how when he interprets some of the contacts with the brethren that he had throughout Asia Minor, he says, For when we were come into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Without were fightings, within were fears. Nevertheless, God, that comforteth those that are cast down, comforted us by the coming of Titus. Paul doesn't tell us what were these indwelling fears, these fears within. Perhaps they were concern or a little anxiety about whether or not he would be able to represent God in Macedonia as well as he would like. Perhaps there were moments of doubts or concerns that he had, which may have indicated a lack of fullness of faith. But whatever they were, Paul was able to overcome in these and was able to experience the blessed comfort that God and his Spirit alone can give. And he tells us the medium by which God can send comfort. He sent his beloved colleague in the faith, Titus. Titus, who came, and I'm sure that as they mutually ministered to each other, there was such a great upliftment that indeed whatever fears Paul may have had about his own adequacy or about his confidence in God, for a moment, like a little dark cloud, that this cloud just passed away in the sunshine of God's favor was fully upon him. And therefore, we are going to have fears within. There are going to be moments when we will express doubt. But I trust, friends, that these will be a signal. These will be a symptom. These will merely be an alarm ringing and telling us that there is something wrong and that we have to go back to God and seek the grace to help in every time of need. It is suggested that fears might come, fears from within, that is, might come from three different sources. And I think that this is quite valid. And Brother Russell suggests this in one of his articles, that we might have fears within because of a sense of weakness. This is not the kind of weakness that we sing about, leaning on thee in my weakness, trusting thee for promised grace, I will take this vow and keep it till I meet thee face to face. Indeed, this is not weakness, this is really strength. But there is a weakness when we sometimes look at self. When I think of self, I tremble. When I look to thee, I am strong. When we sometimes look at ourselves and fail to see the providences of God exercised behind the experience, then we might have a fearfulness or a weakness. Was not this true of Jonah? When he sought to escape from the commission that God had for him to go to Nineveh, why, Jonah did not feel that he was able to do this in such a powerful, a great pagan city. Why, who would listen to the voice of such a insignificant prophet? And therefore, in his fear, inspired by weakness from within, he then endeavored to escape God's providences and God's overruling for him. Or then, collectively, as we think of the nation of Israel, how flushed, how they were invited to go into Canaan, how they were indeed promised the very portals of the promised land, and how because of their fear, because of their looking upon their own natural resources, they thought it better to spy out the land first, and let's see what we're getting into before we walk into a trap. And thus, because of the false report of the spies, they were cast again into the wilderness, where they wandered for some more 38 years. And then again, fear might come from a sense of disesteem, a sense of not fully appreciating what God has provided. And I'm thinking here of Moses, how Moses, who was the meekest man in all the earth, when God had commanded him to go up to give this commission to Pharaoh and to tell Pharaoh to let my people go, how Moses was not quite fully supported in his faith to accept God at his word. And how Moses began to make excuses, began to make an alibi. Why, I need a mouthpiece. I need someone else to help me along. And therefore, give me Aaron for a crutch. See, Moses feared to give this message to the Pharaoh on his own because he disesteemed the power of God. And then, to the offense, we get another source of fear from what mistakes may have been made in the past. That when we think of mistakes that were done, we are fearful then lest we renew them or repeat them in the future. And thus evokes a fearing of fear and of powerlessness. And how this was true of Peter. You remember the impulsive, impetuous Peter was taught a humiliating lesson which he shall never forget throughout all eternity, the lesson of never trust in yourself, never trust in your flesh, never trust in your own devices. And when he told the Master that verily, even though the world would be against you, that he shall not forsake him, and then when the Master told him that before the cock would crow twice, he would deny him thrice, and when all of this happened, and when Peter, heartsick, and when Peter was broken and desolate after the crucifixion of Christ, when the Master appeared to him on the waters, how Peter held back, how Peter was a little bit fearful, he was concerned because of the past mistake, how the Master would accept him. Oh, he was indeed ashamed, and indeed rightly so, but he was fearful lest he would incur the disesteem of his beloved Master. And then we know how sensitively and how gently and kindly the Master reinstated him and told him three times, "Feed my sheep." He had been restored to a condition of favor, to a great position of one of the chief apostles, because he loved the Lord, and that weakness that overtook him for a moment was no reflection upon his affection and his everlasting devotion, rather a reflection upon the humanity that was in this great fisherman. And therefore, dear friends, we trust that as we are passing through this veil of tears, as we are living our moments and our days and our years, that we do so with this attitude of appreciation of our own inadequacy, and that we are fearful lest at any point we are not being rightly exercised by the experiences and by the will of God for us. And thus when Peter, in addressing his first epistle to the church, he says, "It is written, Be ye holy, for I am holy. And if ye call on the Father, who without respect of person judgeth according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear." Peter tells us that we are to pass the time of our sojourning here in fear. Not the kind of fear, dear friends, that paralyzes. Not the fears that panic. Not the fears that terrify as those who have no faith. But, brethren, with the fear that leads to godliness, the fear that leads to devotion, the fear that leads constantly us to ask, "Is it well with my soul? Am I serving thee with the fullness of my being? Dear Lord, cleanse me from all imperfection. Reveal unto me verily the hidden sins, the imperfections that I cannot see, and thus make me more like thyself." If we would ever keep this in mind and sojourn here with fear, I dare say, dear friends, we shall attain the state of perfect love, which casteth out all fear, and ultimately we will be able to achieve a condition of perfection, a condition of immortality, when fear or even the threat thereof will be but a thing of the past. May the Lord add his blessing. May we conclude by the use of that hymn, I Want a Principle Within. Yes, I think it's 198, is that? No, it's